Good morning, everyone. I now call this remote hearing of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Welcome to our very first committee hearing, and welcome particularly for the members who are new to the House or new to the committee. We're looking forward to getting to work with everybody on the committee for a productive session. We're starting with two introductory hearings this week, one today on climate impacts on Minnesota, and one on Thursday on climate solutions coming from our state. We're going to start by taking a roll, and then we do a couple quick introductions, and then we'll go right into our testifiers because we have some great folks here to speak to us today, and I wanna leave plenty of time for questions. But we do need to establish a quorum. When the clerk takes the roll, since this is our very first time as a group, you could also just say present and then say where you're representing and where you're from. So Mike, go ahead with the roll.
Thank you, Jamie. Chair Long.
Present, Representative Jamie Long representing Southwest Minneapolis.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present. Good morning, everybody. Representative Patty Akam. I represent the western suburbs of the metro, Minnetonka, Plymouth, and Woodland.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Hi, this is State Representative Chris Swazinski, 16A. I think you said my name. I'm having a tough time hearing.
My apologies. I'll try and move the mic closer. Representative Bierman.
Good morning, everybody. Representative Robert Bierman, District 57A, Apple Valley and Lakeville.
Representative Bo. Representative Bo. Representative Christensen.
Present. Shelley Christensen, I represent 39B out in the St. Croix Valley area. Thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Representative Franson, live in Alexandria Township, representing the northeastern part of Douglas County and the eastern half of Boston.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Representative Grunhagen, I represent District 18B, which is Sibley McLeod County, which is southwest of Minnesota. Glad to be on the committee. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Good morning, everybody. Athena Hollins, representative for District 66B, which is the northern part of the city of St. Paul.
Representative Hornstein.
Good morning, everybody. Representative Frank Hornstein. I represent District 61A, which includes parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis.
Representative Igo.
Morning, everyone. Representative Igo here, representing House District 5B, making up parts of Itasca and Cass County.
Representative Lee.
Morning, everyone. Representative Lee, House District 59A, which is in North Minneapolis.
Representative Lippert.
Morning, everyone. I represent the Lonsdale, Montgomery, Dundas, and Northfield areas in southern Minnesota. Glad to be a part of this.
Representative Lislegard.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Dave Lislegard. I represent 6B, a large portion of the Iron Range.
Representative Meckland.
Good morning, Representative Shane Mecklen. I represent District 15B, which is Sherburne County, Benton County, President Murray County, east of St. Cloud.
Representative Munson.
Hey everybody, I'm Jeremy Munson. I represent a rural area in southern Minnesota for Watonwan, Waseca, Le Sueur, and Blue Earth counties, south of Mankato. My second term on the Energy Committee.
Representative Stevenson.
Good morning, everyone. Zach Stevenson. I represent Coon Rapids and Champlin.
I think that's our list. So we have a quorum present. I know that Representative Bowe had been on, but it looked like he might have had to disconnect and maybe is trying to reconnect, but we can have him introduce himself when he gets back on. Also, really quickly wanted to have our hardworking, terrific staff introduce themselves so folks know who they are. So we'll start with nonpartisan staff, Bob Eliff.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Bob Eliff with the House Research Department. I've been staffing the Energy Committee since 2004.
And our fiscal analyst, Solveig Beckel.
Hi, my name is Solveig Beckel, and I've been working with the House for about 2 years, and I covered energy and climate last session as well.
And we have a terrific nonpartisan team, as I'm sure you'll find out if you haven't gotten a chance to work with them yet. And then we'll have partisan staff say hello. Mike Molzan, our committee administrator.
Hi, I'm Mike Molzan. I'll be the committee administrator for this biennium.
And Mike Hermanson.
Hello, I'm Mike Hermanson. I'm the CLA for Energy and Climate.
And we'll, Bill Glahn.
Hi, Bill Glahn. I am the Republican researcher for this committee. I've been here since 2015, not as long as Bob, but I've been serving on this committee in whatever form it's taken for the last 6 years.
Eric Anderson.
Good morning, everybody. Eric Anderson, work in DFL research, and this will be my third year working with the Energy Committee.
Great. Has Representative Bowe rejoined us? I'm not seeing him. Okay, so then we will go ahead and move into our testimony. So we have a full lineup today, and we're going to be hearing first from our witnesses, and then we'll hold all questions to the end, please, and we'll take questions at that point. And our first presenter today is Josna Harris with Climate Generation. Please unmute yourself and begin.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. My name is Josna Harris, and I'm the Director of Community Engagement at Climate Generation, a Will Steger legacy. And it's my privilege to join you virtually today from Woodbury, located on the land of the Dakota people. The next few years hold real challenges to reimagine systems. We see the weight of the responsibility that you hold as elected officials in this pivotal moment. Climate change will amplify every challenge facing our communities, as we have seen how COVID-19 has disproportionately impacted communities of color. Minnesota holds many of the worst racial disparities across health, housing, income, and education that also make communities of color among the most impacted by climate change. The opportunity is now to prioritize climate change in a way that is rooted in community voices and that addresses the multiple disparities that our communities face. Along with my testimony, we have submitted a petition from nearly 200 people across the state calling for legislative leadership to match the urgency and the intersectionality of the climate crisis to benefit the health and well-being of all Minnesotans. And for a long time, the way that we have talked about climate change has mostly been from a scientific perspective. But in this time of disinformation and polarization, it's our stories that help us to connect to one another and connect the head and the heart, which is essential to spark and sustain action. Chair Long has helped to frame this hearing today with an emphasis on the importance of sharing our stories of climate change. At Climate Generation, we could not agree more. We are a nonprofit with a mission to empower individuals and their communities to engage in solutions to climate change. And at the core of our work is the power of personal narrative. We were founded by Will Steger, Minnesota's own polar explorer, educator, and climate change advocate, who for over 50 years has inspired tens of thousands of people through his remarkable accounts of climate change in our polar regions, as a witness to the disintegration of some of the world's major ice shelves. We know that sharing our stories of climate change can help to move solutions. Will's testimony has helped to pass the 2007 Next Generation Energy Act, but it has been nearly 15 years since Minnesota led the nation with this bipartisan legislation. Yet public support and the urgency could not be greater with the imprint of climate change all around us. And it is time for Minnesota to lead again. I have my own climate story as a first-generation American. My dad came to Minnesota in the 1960s to work for 3M because it was part of his American dream. In the early days, he would write letters back to family in India to tell them what seemed like tall tales of our Minnesota winters. And growing up, our family would visit India. And for me, growing up here felt like I was part of two very different worlds that were in stark contrast to each other. But the world is a different place than it was 30 years ago. The imprint of climate change is all around us, from the extreme heat and water shortages in India to our warming winters here in Minnesota that impact our ecosystems, health, economy, and traditions. What we do today will define what our world looks like in the next 30 years. Climate change is a global crisis, and especially in this time of pandemic, it has reminded me that the world is not as big as it sometimes seems, and that our stories are all connected. I'm encouraged to know that the majority of Minnesotans are concerned about climate change too, a fact that data tells us is true statewide, and something that I've personally heard from countless youth, educators, and community members across the state. So while it can sometimes feel like our world is broken beyond what can be repaired, I am deeply heartened by the power of our voices coming together to demand climate justice. Climate Generation recently published a book called Eyewitness, Minnesota Voices on Climate Change, and is written by people all across the state of Minnesota sharing their firsthand accounts of climate change through poetry, story, and art. And the diverse range of perspectives represent the communities that you all serve and share impacts and solutions from every corner of our beloved state. Eyewitness is a demonstration of literary activism. It is our testimony of climate change. We're excited to share that this session, Climate Generation is delivering a copy of the Eyewitness book to every Minnesota policymaker, along with testimony letters from your constituents. Members of the committee, in the next few weeks, you will be receiving your copy of the Eyewitness book.
Ms. Harris, letters, if you could please wrap up your remarks.
Yes. Letters and also information for a hearing which will be hosted by the Joint Climate Action Caucus, tentatively scheduled for February 2nd. I'd like to urge you to make a commitment to listen to the voices of your fellow Minnesotans and ask you to hear the urgency in our collective voices and demand that you prioritize climate justice on behalf of all Minnesotans and to protect future generations. Right now, as we speak, my children are upstairs logged into their virtual classrooms. And from talking to them, I know that they have big dreams for what is possible in our world. And they deserve to have those dreams of a bright and promising future, as all of our children do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we will hear from Dr. Lalita Surapanini. Please unmute yourself and begin.
Hi, Chair Long. Thank you so much, Vice Chair Akam and committee members for giving me this opportunity to testify today about the health impacts of climate change in Minnesota. I'm going to share my screen with you all. So I can show you some slides. I testified before this committee, back in 2019 on the same topic as well. I today wanted to see if I could provide a brief recap as well as an overview of what has all happened since 2019. So briefly, after we spoke, in 2019 June, over 100 medical organizations gave a declaration on climate change and said that it's a health emergency that demands immediate action. We also, some of you may remember some of these health impacts of climate change that I spoke about in 2019. So we have heat-related illness, poor air quality and allergies. We also talked about how the Midwest and Minnesota are at high risk for flooding and drought. And we all have witnessed the 2019 devastating Midwest floods and the health impacts that came with that, including mental health impacts on farmers and economic losses. I've submitted a more detailed report for your review. And this is part of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change. It's a key national document, a scientific report that comes out annually, and I was part of it, part of this team. We also talked about how warming winters are not a good thing, and that helps, for example, ticks grow and thrive. And this has led to a rise in Lyme disease. And you can see this data from the Minnesota Department of Health, which is updated and shows an increase in Lyme disease cases. We also discussed how many Minnesotans are facing mental health impacts of climate change, including solastalgia, which is a sense of loss of place and culture because of degradation of our environment. And a lot of us are seeing that with our winters getting warmer and not enough lake ice for us to carry on with our traditions. I also wanted to take some time to talk about, we are seeing that in Minnesota, we're feeling impacts from climate disasters that happen far away from us. For example, a lot of hospitals in the US use saline that is manufactured in Puerto Rico. And we saw that after Maria, that supply chain was disrupted and impacts were felt in hospitals all across the US. We also saw that air quality in Minnesota is being impacted by wildfires in Canada and the West. And in 2020, we also witnessed overlapping health crises of systemic racism, COVID-19, and climate change, and they deepened the existing inequities. So we all know that communities of color and low-income communities suffer the brunt of these impacts. And I wanted to take a second to kind of delve into why that is. So I am an assistant professor at the university, and I practice as a physician at mHealth Fairview. And this is something that I use when I care for my patients. And you should have all received a more detailed handout on this. So with the, I want to direct your attention to those two blue boxes at the bottom that are ability to adapt and exposure. So how I use it as a clinician is that, let's say I have a patient with asthma, and I know that a bad air day can land them in the hospital. So I tell them to do two things. One, reduce exposure. So, you know, limit time outdoors. Two, improve your ability to adapt, so maybe use an inhaler. Now, why is it important for you all to know about this as legislators? It's because you can create changes on a systemic level that can impact the health of not just my patients, but all Minnesotans. For example, with exposure, we know that communities of color have polluted facilities are, you know, disproportionately placed in communities of color and low-income communities, and those impacts are actually felt for decades. For example, there was a study recently that showed that Black Americans who live in previously redlined districts continue to have higher rates of asthma and preterm births today. So we also know that we can promote policies that increase people's ability to adapt, for example, increased access to healthcare. And I finally wanted to also tell you that you all have received a Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change 2020 policy brief, and that has more benefits, health benefits of climate action that is detailed. And we have, and I wanted to leave you all with this slide that I also showed you in 2019. And that's because, you know, the prescription for a healthy climate remains the same. We need to stop actions that damage our climate and take actions that improve the resiliency of our communities so we move towards a future that is safe, fair, and healthy. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we will hear from John Linchevsky. Please unmute yourself and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Linchevsky. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited. And if I could ask Mike to allow me to share my screen, I have some photographs I'd like to share. So if you'd enable that. Briefly, Minnesota Trout Unlimited is a conservation group, grassroots group with members across the state. Our mission is to protect, restore, and sustain cold water fisheries. I want to highlight the cold water aspect of them. Trout and steelhead will be on the front lines of climate change, and projections are not great. Just want to briefly mention, you know, it's you know, trout and steelhead fishing is a huge recreational part of our culture. There's over 120,000 trout and steelhead anglers in the state, so it's a great recreational importance, but it's also a huge economic engine. Just in the southeastern part of the state where there are no natural lakes, so stream fishing is the game, and that's trout fishing, the annual economic impact is close to $880 million a year. So it's a real engine, especially in rural parts of the state, and that's all threatened by climate impact. So I'm here to really just deliver the message that climate impacts are already happening. This isn't theoretical. Sportsmen and women around the state, we're seeing it on the ground. And so it's real. Want to give you a few examples. But I'll just mention I've been, you know, trout angling myself for 40 plus years. And as a steelheader on the North Shore, it's always been the case that steelheading never happens until after April 12th. In the last 10 years, we've had steelheading in March. And things have really shifted. And why does that matter? It means we have a longer summer season of low, warm water, which is negatively impacting, you know, those juvenile fish. So I'm going to shift now to a couple of slides here. Okay, bear with me. Because I want to talk about really the biggest, most obvious impact that we're seeing on the ground, and that is from flooding. We're seeing much more frequent and severe rainfall events, and that translates into more frequent and severe flooding. And this is happening statewide. Briefly, here's a picture of Garvin Brook down near Winona. You'll see tan areas. These are huge areas of cobble from a stream that has been blown apart by flooding. Here's a bird on-the-ground view of what that looks like down on the stream. You'll see the topsoil has been stripped away, leaving highly erodible cut banks and big piles of cobble. There is really no habitat left behind. The stream's very unstable and will continue to erode and cause sedimentation, which buries all the trout habitat. Streams can be restored. This is the same area, narrowed and deepened. But the problem is, you know, widespread and picking up in its pace. Here's a dinky little stream, little brook trout stream. You can see the water flowing on the left-hand side. But look at all that cobble. Even the tiniest streams in the southeast are moving huge amounts of material from these really historically severe floods. But it's not just the southeast. This is on the North Shore. Here's a picture of the Little Stewart River. And you'll say, well, where's the river? That's a good question. It's underneath that pile of cobble. So flooding, this is from the 2012 flooding, obliterated the channel, filled it with sediment. And this had been a premier steelhead spawning area and juvenile production area. It's been buried. again, take a look. You'll notice there's an arrow at the willow tree behind this gentleman. Same willow tree. So here we were able to restore that channel and kind of recreate a floodplain. And that's fine for that one little stretch of river. But again, it's happening everywhere. Here's another picture from the Blackhoof River in Carlton County, where that same flood actually brought entire hillsides down into the river. The forest rode down the slopes and dumped into the river, blocking it and causing all kinds of burying the river in sediment. Again, you know, we can restore pieces. Here we've moved the stream away from the bluff. And maybe a better picture here, you can see we moved the stream away from that eroding slopes. But again, this is happening all over the state, and it's devastating. Tears apart channels, destabilizes them, fills in habitat, covers food production areas and spawning areas. So those are just, you know, a few examples from around the state. And then I want to return, you know, very quickly here, because I'm probably almost out of time. What we've noticed, what I've noticed as a steelhead angler, is the mild winters we've been seeing. And that's really kind of stands out. We have midwinter snowmelt that runs off into the Lake Superior in this case, or into our streams when they're frozen. And why that's bad is it leaves, again, this longer period of warm, low summer water. But also what's happening, especially in the Northeast, is a change in the forest, and that those milder winters are causing a rise in the level of tree pests. And the latest one is spruce budworm, which is killing whole stands of balsam and spruce along our trout streams. And so here's one picture of the Gooseberry River, great trout river, but it's in danger of becoming too warm for trout because the entire stream corridor for miles is losing its shade cover. So these are just some of the impacts we're seeing. The lake trout, our heritage lake trout in the, say, the boundary waters, those are being squeezed. The area where it's suitably cold enough and have enough oxygen is getting smaller and smaller in these, even the boundary waters lakes. And so it's reducing the productivity and habitat for, you know, lake trout and their prey. So, you know, I'll just sort of conclude by saying, you know, habitat or climate change is real. It's happening right now. It's not theoretical. Sportsmen and women who are out in the field, we're seeing it. And so, you know, it matters for our culture, for our constitutional right to fish in the state. It matters for our economy. And so we urge action, and we thank you for this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you so much. Next, we're going to hear from Craig Sturl. Craig, please unmute yourself and begin.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Long and committee members. I'm going to first introduce myself. I am a retired DNR forester. I worked for 32 years for the DNR. I worked 42 years in wildland fire, and I'm not going to talk about wildland fire. I think we've all seen what's happening across the West. Eventually, that's going to happen here as the climate swings from one extreme to the other. But I want to talk a little bit about the economic challenges facing the logging community and the forest products industry. I and others see the warming winters as an existential threat to the ability, the logistics of being able to log in much of northern Minnesota's forests. Approximately 40% of our wood base is in lowland timber types. That would be black spruce, tamarack, white cedar, ash, lowland hardwoods. And most of these forest types grow on soils that are saturated year-round. So the only opportunity to harvest on these sites is during the winter when the ground is frozen. We have winters like this where we simply are no longer having sufficient cold weather to allow loggers to freeze the ground, freeze the harvest site, so that they can go in and harvest the trees and remove those. The seasons as well are getting shorter and shorter in the wintertime. The freeze up is coming later. The breakup in the spring is coming earlier. And this is kind of an economic challenge for the loggers. They have to purchase wood in advance, not knowing what the coming winter or next several winters are going to be like. And they have to, and particularly when dealing with agencies within the state, whether it's the state, the Forest Service, the counties, they have to put a down payment down on that sale. And quite often, they may go several years not being able to enter the woods to harvest that wood. And of course, there is still upland timber that will be available in the wintertime, but this is something of a cannibal problem because usually the loggers want to save that dry upland wood for the summertime. But if they have to log it in the winter, it's no longer available to them in their wood basket. And so they have to bid higher for those few tracts of dry summer ground. And that, by dry summer ground, I'm talking sandy, gravelly soils that you can operate on pretty much any time. We face a dilemma where our summers are getting wetter, at least so far. That's what the data is showing. So loggers are also struggling somewhat in the summer times. When we get these big rainfall events that John just described, it takes probably 10 days to 2 weeks for these sites to dry out for the loggers to move back into these high ground sites. The load-bearing strength of wet soils is very poor. I mean, that's why farmers don't go out when the soils are wet, because the equipment sinks. Loggers are no different. They cannot access these wet sites, whether it's summer or winter, if they're not suitably dry or frozen. So this is because there's 40% of our wood tied up in this difficult country that we have here in northern Minnesota. This is going to impact the ability of loggers to provide wood for the wood industry, and it's going to be a challenge for the mills to stay open. And I don't have a solution for getting around this problem. Logging requires huge pieces of equipment. They're heavy, and you simply can't put them out there on those unfrozen soils or too wet soils and expect them not to do severe damage and at a terrible economic cost to the loggers. So, unfortunately, I just read a report where there's a model saying that our climate is, the impacts of this are basically baked in right now for a foreseeable future for the climate to continue to warm. This is a really disastrous forecast for the logging industry and for the wood product industry, not just here in Minnesota, but I heard from a third-party certifier that does certification on Minnesota's forest lands that this is a problem even up in Canada. So escaping this is going to be almost impossible. And I unfortunately don't have a solution for you other than the obvious, which is to deal with climate change up front. We need to reduce our carbon footprint and start working on the real base problem of climate change. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we will be hearing from Tom Cotter. Tom, please unmute yourself and begin.
Hi, can you see me okay?
We sure can.
Okay, I'm out in nature, kind of the fact of trying to meet up with my daughter, but also because we can put digital back prints on our computers for the rest of our lives. We might not always be able to stand out in nature like I am doing right now. So I'd like to thank you, Mr. Long, for inviting me and including us. My name is Tom Cotter. I farm down in southern Minnesota, right on the Moore-Freeborn County line. I'm just on the edge of I-90, so I have a lot of people coming by my farm. You know, all day long, there's thousands and thousands of people. So they see what I do, and I'm going to give you examples of what I do. I'm a regular farmer. I grew up my whole life doing tillage, planting corn, planting soybeans, and realizing that, you know, it was a dead end. I never really got ahead. The farming economy right now, granted, we have prices have just risen, but also our inputs have risen. So people see my farm. So I started changing. I started putting cover crops out on the ground. I started putting livestock back on the ground. It's a very vast difference from one side of the I-90 to the other. My side is I can suck in the water. I can infiltrate water into the soil, which keeps my creeks cleaner. But on the other side, there's a large corporate farms that till that soil nonstop, and there are lakes out there every time it rains. It takes 1 inch of rain, all of a sudden it ponds, and then you get another inch on top, and then it starts running. You know, back when I was younger, 1-3 inches of rain, yes. But now we're getting 3 inch, 5 inch, 7 inch. You know, it's impossible to hold that if we've been doing the same practices we've always done, which is tilling the soil. And I know that water can infiltrate because I actually grew up doing tiling. We had a tile plow. We put a lot of tile on the ground. And I realized it's not a tile drainage problem. It's an infiltration. We have abused our soil to the point where it can't absorb the water. And we talk about the streams. And we can rebuild all this. But if we have this water running off our fields because of climate change, and actually, in my words, it's almost like a climate extreme. We actually are getting these high heat days. We're also getting these really cold days. Water, we're getting lots of rain, and we're getting lots of drought. So overall, during my farming years, I see the same moisture, but I'm only getting that moisture in a short amount of time, so I need to capture as much of that as possible. Now, the way we're farming nowadays, we're letting that stuff run off into our rivers. And we talk about trout and fishing. Well, what if my fields are bringing the chemicals off the fields and putting that into the fish? Is that helping us? You know, fish are beautiful, but if they're not healthy, it's not going to make us healthy. And so with sustainable agriculture, regenerative agriculture, mindful thought, and that's why LSP, which I'm a board member, or I'm a member of, they're helping the farming community find ways to reduce our impact on the environment. And we all know that, you know, right now we're going through all these viruses and disease is rampant. Health-wise, we're the sickest nation in the world, and we're only getting sicker. Well, what if Mother Nature is starting to fight back? A virus is when an animal gets put under stress. When the environment gets put under stress, it reacts. And that's what this whole world is seeing right now. Mother Nature's reacting, and we're having a hard time keeping healthy people. We think we're spending money on regenerative agriculture and sustainable agriculture, but actually, when we spend money on that, it's also saving us money on health. You know, tourism, the state, if we don't have clean waters, we can't bring in that $16 billion a year for the Minnesota state to get money. You know, for me as a farmer, I'm clean water certified through Minnesota State Department of Ag. That's a pretty good sign that Minnesota knows there's a problem and we want to help. And so I'm climate endorsed, soil health endorsed, wildlife endorsed. And really to me, pest management, because even the smallest insects, bees, they're the easiest ones to harm. And so to me, to be able to take care of them, that's where it all starts, is down those microbes in the soil. And when you do tillage, you wreck that. if you don't have earthworms, you can't infiltrate the water. That water runs off, takes our chemical with it. And really, the $16 billion industry of tourism is great if you have clean water. And our environment is saying, hey, stop, we need help. And it's starting to react to us, and it's giving us autism at all-time rates, cancer all-time rates. The coronavirus, which is, yes, it's terrible, but it's just a piece of the big puzzle that we're affecting Mother Nature more than we can ever imagine. And Mother Nature will survive. I don't know if we can, but Mother Nature will. That's the way life has always been. Life will always grow. You know, everyone always asks me, how do you get stuff planted? Said Mother Nature, seeds want to grow. That's what they will do. But we need to start taking care of how we plant them, how we take care of the soil, how we take care of this water that we're getting. Water is a gift. I had an opportunity to go down to Oaxaca, Mexico, and an indigenous person taught me about rich water and poor water. Poor water is rain that falls from the sky, hits our soil, can't infiltrate, runs off carrying our expensive chemical, our expensive nutrients into our waters. And now it's wrecked it. But now rich water is water that falls from the skies, infiltrates, goes through the soil profile, lands into aquifers, in which our aquifers are drying up. That's why more of the utilities around the world in our United States are using river water.
Mr.
River water will never replace. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Next, we're going to hear from Kathy Drager. Kathy, please unmute yourself and begin.
Hello. Can you see me? I'm assuming you can.
We sure can. Yep.
Okay. Chairman Long and community members, thank you very much for having me join you today from rural Big Stone County, Minnesota. I am so pleased that I was able to follow those speakers, and I can wholeheartedly attest to the impacts they're seeing on their farms and in their forest resources. Those are very similar to what I'm seeing on the western edge of Minnesota. So my name is Kathy Drager. I am a proud and active member of the Minnesota Farmers Union. I am an elected representative on my rural electric co-op. So I have a hand in providing energy to thousands of rural residents. And we've been electrifying this part of the state, fully electrified since the end of World War II. In addition, I am the statewide director of the University of Minnesota Extension Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. I'm trained as a soil scientist, so I just want to reiterate that there's science behind the things that both Tom was saying about his farmland, as well as what we're hearing about the forestry as well. But today you've invited me here to tell you the story about the impacts that I'm seeing on our farm in Big Stone County, Minnesota. Our farm is a diversified family farm. My husband is active every day in our farm, and we have three children who also are part of our farm operation. We raise grass-fed beef. We have organic row crops. So, for example, if you like black turtle beans and eat organic black turtle beans, that's one of the things we grow on our farm. We grow barley, hay as well, that we feed our cattle in the winter, and a portion of our farm is in conventional corn and soybean rotations. And I just want to really reiterate, and I think Dr. Seeley, who is just really an esteemed thinker and educator, researcher in our state on climate as well as weather, but that we are seeing those increased rainfall events on our farm, extreme rainfall events. As Greg said, those are impacting forestry as well as farming. And Dr. Seeley has the data that shows what we are experiencing on the landscape. So it's a good combination of on the ground, what folks are seeing and experiencing, as well as what we are learning from data. So, for example, the year that we planted organic edible black beans, we got our beans in the ground, got our seed in the ground, and then we had one of those massive rainfall events. And since we're organic, we really depend on cultivating, which means running a light digger across the top of the soil to get the budding weed seeds out so that our crop can outcompete the weeds without having to use chemical spray on it. That's how we practice organic agriculture. We were unable to do that. And so we were really racing to fight the weeds overpowering our bean crop because we were unable to get in with mechanical tillage to do that. And that was that extreme rainfall event was followed immediately by what was called a flash drought, where we had absolutely no rain whatsoever for weeks on end, so that our soil was cracked. You could see the large cracks in our clay soil. So we went from extreme rainfall to extreme drought on one crop season. And I just wanted to share with you how that could impact us. Those of us who like, I'm a fan of beans, and you know, how that could impact a crop like organic edible beans. So in addition to impacting our ability to grow crops, because that's one of the scary things about climate change is we've been depending on agriculture to support feeding our population for thousands of years. And with this change, it leaves us with a lot of uncertainty to how we're going to be able to do that. Farmers are innovating. Farmers are adapting. But this is happening really fast. You think about the hundreds of generations it took to get to the agriculture we have today. And now we're trying to do these changes in the matter of years. So I will tell you some of the things that we're doing as far as solutions on our farm. Which we've also experienced some serious erosion because the water is moving across the landscape so fast. And as Tom mentioned, with the tiling, that helps to accelerate the speed of the water. And when that comes into my farm, we have a culvert on the north side, it rips an erosive channel that's feet deep. And we're in the process of trying to deal with that. And one way that we have is that we've put in and installed grass waterways. So these areas where the water naturally flows, instead of just leaving those open and farming those, we've installed grass waterways where the water can flow. So grass waterways is one way that we can do this. Now, since we're a medium-sized farm, we can still work around that. Our equipment is sized so that we can work around grass waterways on our farm. In addition, we restored a wetland. I can lean forward and look at it over here to my right. We restored a 30-acre wetland with associated upland. That's a beautiful piece of habitat. We have pollinator plants in there. It's full of wildlife, ducks, geese, swans. And 10 years ago, I would look out there and see my soybeans underwater. So one of the solutions we use, instead of constantly investing $10,000 to drain 30 acres of land that constantly was underwater, we put in a wetland and we restored that piece of habitat. And so that provides a benefit to us as well. So we were able to put that into the RIM program. That's a Minnesota program as well. One of the other things we did in terms of solution and sitting on a rural electric co-op board, that we installed a 40 kW wind turbine on our farm. It's a farm scale turbine, but it supplies all the power we use on our farm. Plus, we're able to put power back onto the grid, which is also supplied then to our neighbors. And that's not necessarily industrial scale renewable energy, but it is certainly a contribution. And I think it's a way that we need to work with our rural electric co-ops, help them find business models that they can have some benefit from being engaged in the clean energy transition, because the business model currently really is based on we sell electricity. And so I think there's a lot of potential there. And as a rural electric co-op board, I continue to have that conversation at the local, state, and national level.
Ms. Baker, you're out of time. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next, we're going to hear from Mindy Granley. Mindy, if you could unmute yourself and begin.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, Chair Long and representatives, and thank you all for the work that you do for the public and the state of Minnesota. My name is Mindy Granley, and I'm the Sustainability Officer for the City of Duluth. I'm here to tell you a little bit about our climate change issues today. As mentioned by several of the speakers already today, one of the climate challenges we face in Duluth is warming winters, as northern Minnesota is warming faster than the rest of the state, which many of the folks have mentioned today. Along with this warming comes an increase in the number of freeze-thaw cycles during winter, which can damage our infrastructure and age it prematurely. Another concern with increased is climate change is increased precipitation overall, but especially extreme weather events and increased storm intensity, such as the flooding and wind storms that have damaged the city of Duluth in recent years that you've probably heard a lot about. Duluth is also a city with identified environmental justice issues, and many areas in our city have at least 40% of people reporting income less than 185% of the federal poverty level. So equity and climate change go together in our city as well. Five climate actions that the city is currently working on include more sustainable buildings, a sustainable buildings policy is needed for city-owned buildings. In my previous role working at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, I saw firsthand how the B3 requirements for energy efficiency helped our campus reduce emissions despite growth in square footage. Energy efficiency standards ensured this, and having stronger energy code for all the cities in Minnesota would help our climate mitigation efforts, along with creating jobs and saving resources long-term. So we're working on an internal policy for city-funded buildings, but our entire community could benefit from a statewide update. Stronger energy codes to increase efficiency would help our residents save energy, increase their comfort, and also their resiliency in the future with extreme weather. We're also working to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals of 80% by 2050, and our response has included the creation of an energy fund to reduce energy use through building improvements. That includes installing efficient lighting, building controls, and also some renewable energy. However, this energy fund isn't nearly adequate and large enough. We have larger investments we still need to do to city buildings. On renewable energy, the city invests in solar power where we can, including a 400 kilowatt purchase in the first community solar garden in northern Minnesota through a partnership with Minnesota Power, which helps save the city money long term. We've also installed smaller city-owned arrays, like a 45-kilowatt electric vehicle charging array in Canal Park and a 5-kilowatt system along LED-lit street rails. We've made utility investments, modernizing our downtown thermal district Duluth Energy Systems to increase efficiency and switch from steam to hot water. We work to update our stormwater system to better respond to larger precipitation events, and we've also replaced leaking water mains. But continued investment in infrastructure is needed. And when these investments are made to replace aging infrastructure, climate mitigation and adaptation should be factors in all of our decision-making. Finally, we are reconstructing the Duluth Lake Walk to be more resilient to stronger storms and the climate of our future. In the future, we hope to address residential energy efficiency in a city with old housing stock and neighborhood equity disparities. How can energy efficiency programs help address these together? In Duluth, this means moving from fossil fuels to electrification in 100-year-old homes. We want to advance our conservation improvement program with our city-owned gas utility. We know we can do more. We want to decarbonize our downtown thermal district and aim to explore electrification opportunities and ways to avoid locking ourselves into additional fossil gas boiler purchases. We aim to explore low-income solar financing and seek ways to take advantage of low-income solar rebates from our utility, but we know funding options for low- and middle-income populations are a challenge. We aim to look at large-scale solar, exploring old landfill sites, brownfield sites, and wherever else it makes sense to produce energy locally, and we'll be seeking partnerships in this work. Finally, to increase neighborhood resiliency, we are collaborating to build community capacity and prepare people in our community who are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change in Duluth. One way is through the Great Lakes One Watershed Partnership, which is local foundations, Ready North, Minnesota Sea Grant, Equilibrium 3, and the city who have applied for pilot projects and funding to work in the Lincoln Park neighborhood. In summary, the city of Duluth supports energy policies that encourage electrification, expand renewable energy, advance conservation, create partnerships, and raise building energy efficiency standards. I welcome you all to visit us in Duluth when the pandemic eases and meeting together is possible. We have a great story to show you about the work we're doing, and I'd like you to be able to see it for yourself. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for being with us. Lauren Jensen is up next. Please unmute yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Long and committee members. My name is Lauren Jensen, Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Rochester. I'm honored to speak to you today about the important work we are doing in Rochester to address climate change and resiliency, share with you the partnerships we have formed, and provide some specific examples of an innovative engagement approach we used, in addition to our future plans. I'd also like to highlight a few of my colleagues tuning in today who have been integral to this work: Cindy Steinhauser, City of Rochester Community Development Director; Kevin Bright, Energy and Sustainability Director for Destination Medical Center; and Heather Corcoran, City of Rochester Legislative Policy Analyst. After a robust public citizen engagement process in 2017, the City of Rochester adopted its Energy Action Plan, setting goals aligned with the state of Minnesota to reduce energy and overall greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. Rochester's Energy Action Plan includes strategies identified around five areas: power infrastructure, integrating renewables, building-focused initiatives, transportation, and waste. Since the Energy Action Plan's adoption, the city has pursued a variety of sustainability initiatives, including a citywide air quality monitoring program, the evaluation of a district energy system that would heat and cool four government buildings in our downtown, as well as serve private development, free bike sharing program and community bike grant giveaway, a voluntary benchmarking program for energy use in buildings, an electric vehicle fleet analysis, the implementation of an internal city green team, and many more. Additionally, city sustainability staff participates in a variety of statewide and national cohorts, including the University of Minnesota's Institute on Environment, Climate Smart Municipalities Exchange of German Cities, City Energy Network, Minnesota Green Subsidies, Sustainable States Network's Clean Energy Challenge, and a statewide STEP Code Committee working to give cities the ability to determine their destiny as it relates to their energy code. As to the specific way we've innovated with our community engagement, 4 years into the implementation of our Energy Action Plan, we realized we were lacking social equity and diversity in its implementation. In our typical government community outreach process, an open house held at city facilities, we were noticing the same people attending and offering very similar input. We knew portions of our community were missing from these processes and recognized we need better engagement, particularly voices from underrepresented communities. Under Mayor Kim Norton's leadership, and with the support of City Council and additional community partners, such as the Destination Medical Center, we convened a task force to develop and implement a community sustainability and resiliency action plan. Collaborating with our local diversity council, Olmsted County Public Health, and other local entities, we put together a task force that would represent the voices of Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and then utilize this community task force to further identify and connect with who we were missing in this process. City staff held 37 one-on-one and small group listening sessions, meeting with a total of 110 community members to understand their lived experience as a member of the Rochester community and what they envision for Rochester's future across five focus areas: climate change, economy, health, vibrant neighborhoods, and transportation. A community survey offered in four languages, English, Spanish, Somali, and Arabic, was live from October through December, collecting an additional 170 responses from the community. All of this collected input was then brought back to our community task force to use in the development of strategies across those five focus areas for the plan. Once completed, this draft plan will be brought back to those engaged community members to ensure their input was thoughtfully captured. Since this initiative launched, we have been nationally recognized for our engagement process by the United States Conference of Mayors in their 2020 Mayor's Climate Protection Awards, and we were recently notified of another award we've earned to be announced later this month. Lastly, I'll speak to our future plans. The city already has plans to use this type of engagement process in the future for other public processes to best capture key needs from community members that don't typically share in public meetings. Additionally, we are currently in the process of hiring a diversity, equity, and inclusion director to continue this work across the city organization and within the community. As for climate change initiatives, we continue to identify strategies that put us closer to our adopted energy and greenhouse gas emissions reductions goals. In 2021, we plan to complete a community electric vehicle infrastructure plan, install additional electric vehicle chargers, continue implementation of a downtown district energy system, implement internal sustainability strategies related to procurement and waste, and expect to share the first draft of our Sustainability and Resiliency Action Plan with our City Council later this spring. The plan will highlight roughly 30 strategies across the five focus areas, with a pilot project identified for each focus area, three of which will be located within environmental justice census tracts in our community. The City of Rochester understands the connection between climate change, our community's future resilience, and environmental justice. And we're committed to being a leader both regionally and nationally in these efforts. Thank you, Chair Long, and I'll be available for any questions the committee may have after all the presenters are finished.
Thank you so much. Our final speaker today before we go to member questions is Dr. Mark Seeley. Dr. Seeley, if you could unmute yourself and begin.
Oh, thank you, Representative Long. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I was asked by the committee to elaborate a little bit about recent climate signatures on our state. Those unfamiliar with my work, I retired in 2018 after 40 years with the University of Minnesota Extension, working day with the National Weather Service and the Minnesota State Climatology Office. In a nutshell, I was a caretaker and validator and supporter of the Minnesota State Climate Database, which tens of thousands of Minnesota citizens have contributed to since statehood in 1858. My posture on this topic is solely based on research, data, and evidence that is overwhelming in its substantiation of climate change going on in our state. I do have one slide I would like to share to elaborate my further comments. I'll put that up. Again, in the context of what's happened to us recently and how it fits with our larger scale story of climate change in the state of Minnesota, particularly manifested over the last three or four decades. The year 2020 was the 12th warmest year in our state history, back to 1895. It fits very well with the trends we have been observing since the new millennium. The vast majority of years have been warm years, and a very large number of them have fallen in or near the top of the distribution historically. Conversely to the year 2019, which was the wettest year in Minnesota state history.
Dr. Seeley?
Yes.
We're not seeing your slide. I don't know if you're sharing it on your end or if you'd like us to share it on ours.
If you could share it, I'm sorry you're not seeing it.
No problem.
Yeah, if you could pull it up, I would appreciate it. There we go.
We've got it now. Go right ahead.
Is that good? Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Thank you. I've already made my remarks about the temperature signature of 2020. With respect to the precipitation or moisture signature of 2020, it was the 35th driest year in our state history, back to 1895. It did not fit with the trend since the new millennium. Dominantly, those have been wetter than normal years. And I was referring to 2019 being the wettest year in state history, again, on a statewide basis. It was manifestly the wettest year in state history. We had so much surplus moisture that our stored soil moisture values, as well as our volume of stream flow in most of our watersheds, was extraordinarily high all year and remained high as we entered the year 2020. so that some would argue that we needed a drier than normal year in 2020 to sort of get back to a basic normal in the first place. We did have a mega rainfall event, another one on July 25th, 26th in southern Minnesota, south central Minnesota, where we had a 1,000 square mile area of the landscape receive over a 6-inch rain in less than 24 hours with a peak core value of 11.5 inches. We've talked about this for years, and it was mentioned by previous speakers that the disturbing aspect of this weather extreme is that it is increasing in frequency in our lifetime. In terms of the amplified variability that our climate signature shows, it showed it dramatically in the year 2020 when we had the fifth coldest October in state history and the snowiest October in state history. But then that was immediately followed by the 11th warmest November in state history. And in fact, we established in the month of November, the first 9 days of November, we had four statewide records set across the state for high temperature. And we had the first November in state history where we had within the climate network a reporting of 80 degree temperatures in the state on four consecutive days. That's never happened before. I might also add a marker of the extremes that we experienced was that on November 9th, we had a dew point in the state of Minnesota of 61 degrees, and that is the highest measured dew point so late in the year in Minnesota's history. That too dovetails well with the climate change story in that our atmosphere over Minnesota has been growing in its volume as it's warmed over the decades, and it is far more capable of holding that level of moisture today than it was 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 years ago, and that is going to continue. We had all-time state record high temperatures set on the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th, and then we had numerous dew point driven heat advisories, once again, another topic that we've dealt with in our research over the years, that now the National Weather Service is more frequently having to issue heat advisories or excessive heat warnings to the citizens of our state. And this is dominantly due not too high ambient, but because we've been combining our traditional 90 degree temperature days in the summer with exceptionally high dew points that then push the heat index up to an unhealthy level. Just also emphasize that I've been part of the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership statewide committee since the year 2007. This committee is dedicated to sharing of climate adaptation, people working in natural resource management, agriculture, energy, transportation, public health, public works, any number of other fields come together periodically to have an annual statewide conference. This year, this month, next week, it's being held in a Zoom session on January 20th. And I've listed the website for it. I would encourage all the members of your committee, I would encourage all the members of the Minnesota legislature, period, to consider this as one of the most important subgroups operating right now in our state, in the sense that we're all sharing knowledge of what can be practiced, what can be improved to better adapt to our changing climate so that we can preserve our natural resources and we can preserve our quality of life in Minnesota by preserving our state's infrastructure. So this, I think, has become a very important piece of our greater Minnesota community, the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership Group. And I would encourage that that the legislative members consider this or taking an interest in it or at least keeping up with it. Lastly, I'd also mention that next week we have a book launch for the second edition of Minnesota's, of the history of Minnesota's natural heritage, a book famously published in the 1990s by Dr. John Tester and then recently revised in its second edition. And once again, I would consider for reference reading by all Minnesota legislators that they read this history of our natural heritage, what our state is all about. This is very important to understand that so that we can understand the context of climate change and what it's doing to our state. So that's the extent of my remarks. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and look forward to any discussion or questions people may have.
Thank you so much, Dr. Seely, and thank you to all of our testifiers for the sobering and illuminating comments. We do have a few questions. I'm going to begin with one very brief one for Dr. Seely. Doctor, I've heard you say in the past that Minnesota is seeing the fastest change in climate of any state in the nation, and I'm wondering if that is still holding true.
Well, it depends on what variable you're talking about. There's so many to consider, but with respect to the two primary variables that most people talk about, and that being temperature and precipitation, Minnesota remains in terms of the amplified signal, that is the level of signal that's going on in our state year by year and decade by decade. It is most amplified, and when we do compare it to the other 50 states, it's not quite up there with Alaska in terms of the temperature change, but it's definitely in the top 5% across all our landscapes. Even if you subdivide that, Representative Long, like you look at the internal geography of our state, you will find disparity in the signal in the sense that the change in temperature is more amplified, that is of a higher pace of change in the northern Minnesota landscapes than it is in the southern Minnesota landscapes. Secondly, there's also within state disparity in the signal of the precipitation change, where decade by decade, it might be a modest 5 or 10% increase in annual precipitation in some parts of the state, but it might be as high as 30 to 35% change in some other areas of the state.
Thank you so much, Dr. Seely. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much to all the speakers. I thought that was a great presentation and certainly eye-opening. Yesterday, my question is going to be for Mindy Granley with the City of Duluth. Yesterday, I heard a statistic about the cost to the United States last year of climate-related natural disasters, and I think it was $95 billion with a B, dollars. And so in many of the presentations we heard today, we heard about the impacts to kind of industries that are tradition, that are part of the Minnesota tradition, from logging and farmers and forestry and fishing. And then we heard from Ms. Granley about the freeze-thaw cycle in Duluth and the increasing, the more we see of that, that it's impacting our infrastructure. And so on that line of cost, do you have any cost to the, do you have an estimate of the cost to the City of Duluth on those increasing freeze-thaw cycle so that we can be looking at things in the big picture? Professor Seely just talked about how we look at temperature and precipitation. I think we also need to be looking at the cost to our state each year to address the impacts of climate change. And so I'm wondering if you, Ms. Granley, have any information about that for Duluth.
Ms. Granley.
Thank you, Representative Akam. I don't have the numbers offhand, but I do know that particularly in our stormwater system, there is an estimate to the number of upgrades that need to be made to address increased precipitation events in our city. And it's many more millions than we have, of course, on hand to take care of those issues. And so one of the things looking into the future is when infrastructure is repaired, make that decision and spend a little more each time we're making a small decision about what size pipe, how to address a certain issue in our city. And we have a dedicated stormwater utility staff that are trying to make those decisions one at a time as available. The backlog of work to immediately upgrade all of our infrastructure is more than we could ever hope to address in the next decade. But making those decisions with each project is the most vital way to get to that, and making sure we're integrating what's the climate of our future, not just today, each time we make a decision about a small project. I'm sorry, I don't have specifics.
That's very helpful, so thank you.
Yes, yeah, certainly could gather them if they're be helpful.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. See, I just want to start out, too, and thank the people who testified here this morning. We appreciate your perspective. I think we can all say we agree we want a clean environment, okay? I have, in all my meetings or whatever, I have yet to run into somebody who doesn't, okay? So that brings me to the point where I think we agree on the facts and the data. It doesn't seem to be disagreement about that. Where the contention comes in a little bit is through the interpretation, conclusions, and theories that come out of the data. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm acquiring books for everybody in our committee, along with testifiers, hopefully, within the next week or 10 days. The name of the book is Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming. And it's written by three eminently qualified scientists. First is Dr. Idzo. He's a climatologist, is one of the world's leading experts on the effects of carbon dioxide on plant and animal life. Also, Dr. Carter. He's a geologist, environmentalist, scientist, and emeritus fellow of the Institute of Public Affairs in Australia. And then Dr. Fred Singer. He's a physicist and chairman of the Science and Environmental Policy Project, along with a lot of other credentials. And basically, my question is for you, Chairman Long. If we have well-qualified scientists, and by the way, on this book, they make a number, it's relatively layman written, but it says, just one statement I'll say, probably the most widely reported claim in the debate over global warming or climate change is that 97% of the scientists agree that climate change is man-made and dangerous. This claim is not only false, but its presence in the debate is an insult to science. And so I will get this booklet for everybody and send it out. And then if I do have qualified scientists in the area of climate change, climatologists, and those, would you be open to having testimony from them on the facts and the data and why they might disagree? Because I find that when you hear both sides of an issue, that's one of the best ways for us to learn. And I've tried to read both sides, okay? The last comment would be, and then I appreciate your response, we see California has been a leading state going down the Green New Deal or the climate change deal. And it's been a disaster out there, whether it's the fires, which they no longer clean the brush away, like they did when I was in the Marine Corps out there.
Representative Grunhagen, do you have a question for the witnesses? We just have a few other people on the list. I'm happy to respond to your question.
Would you be open for qualified scientists who disagree with the climate change agenda to also video in and testify at a future meeting?
Representative Grunhagen, I'd be happy to see who you are suggesting, and we can have a further discussion about anybody. My understanding from having read many scientific reports and spoken to many scientists is that the number of individuals who question the overwhelming validity of and overwhelming evidence of climate scientists as expressed by reports such as the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are diminishingly few, and I don't want to misrepresent to our committee the views of a few individuals over the overwhelming majority of science. But I would be happy to see who you are suggesting, and we can have that conversation.
Yeah, and I would respectfully disagree with that, to tell you the truth. But okay, thanks for being open to it.
Representative Lippert. Long, may I just say
Dr. Seeley, go ahead.
Just a quick note. Those of you that know me, I have about 50 years of experience in meteorology and climatology. I've engaged with the World Meteorological Organization in Geneva, the Royal Meteorological Society in England, the American Geophysical Union, and the American Meteorological Society, as well as Environment Canada, as well as the American Society of State Climatologists. These are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of scientists who have dedicated their lives to the study of the Earth's atmosphere and climate. And it is an exceedingly small percentage of all of these people that have the views expressed in an exceedingly small percentage.
Thank you, Dr. Seeley. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Chair Long. And I'm wondering if Mr. Cotter is still with us. And if he's not, I can ask this of...
Looks like he is. Go right
thank
ahead.
You, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cotter. I appreciate so much your presentation and sharing with us today. So I hear from farmers all the time of the increased rain that they're seeing, both increased volume of rain and the intensity of droughts too. And they're trying to figure out how to move towards a more resilient model of agriculture. I think they've been aware of the sorts of changes that you're making on your farm, but also wondering if it will work for them on their farm. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the economic benefits I assume you're seeing if you're sticking with these changes and what you say to other farmers who may ask those sorts of questions.
Yeah, I was asked once, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead.
Okay. I was asked once if cover crops and no-till will work on all farms. And it'll absolutely work on all farms. It'll work on all environments all around the world because it's nature. But now, is every farmer ready to work with that? No, they are not. You know, I was trained just as my dad was. We did a tillage for 140 years. That's a whole lot of addiction. And when you do that to the soil becomes addicted. Just like a young man who's addicted to drugs, the tillage gets addicted. So it takes the process of taking care of the soil and reducing your tillage slowly, implementing cover crops. And on the financial side, you know, there's both sides. One, I'm planting more seeds, but tell you what, seeds are Mother Nature. They will work. Tillage, on the other hand, is man-made, and ever since the beginning of the plow, all these empires have fallen from, you know, they only last 200 to 400 years. And we're kind of in that category right now. So, yes, it will work. Farmers need education. I always feel that education is of the utmost importance. I was actually talking to a young 18-year-old kid and a 16-year-old brother that financially – some of the sharpest kids I've ever met. They're already growing food. They're grazing cattle. They're doing cattle. And they want to get into this industry of working with Mother Nature because that's going to give them a better product. That's going to make their farm more resilient. And the whole key is education. So please help these, you know, industries, Minnesota Department of Ag, Soil and Water, NRCS, the education for the farmers and for the whole people, too, in general. So sorry for being long-winded, but I hope that helps.
Thank you, Mr. Cotter. Representative Lippert, is that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cotter. That fits with what I've been hearing as well, is that key pieces are financial support for making these sorts of changes initially, but also technical support too, because there's some different models that the farmers are embracing and talking about increasing. So thank you again for sharing with us today.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. We have two more questions, and that'll probably do us for time. Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to be on this committee. I have a lot to learn, and it was very good, and a lot of information was shared today. But we live in a global economy and we also live in a global environment. So my question to you is that if we in the state of Minnesota are doing it better than others across the world, you know, when we talk about the global environment, where is the pollution coming from? Because in the state of Minnesota and in this country, we have some of the strictest rules and regulations and oversight of anywhere in the world. So I have a hard time believing that when we're talking about this change, it does not go straight up and come straight down. So I ask you, where is this pollution, the majority of this pollution coming from, and what are we doing about it?
Well, that's a great question, Representative Lislegard. So we will be having a hearing on just that topic in just a couple of weeks. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is releasing their biannual report on our ability to meet our greenhouse gas targets as a state, and that will go through sector by sector where we're seeing pollution coming from. So hopefully.
Thank you, Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Lislegard. Representative Hornstein, you'll have the final question.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for a fantastic and informative hearing. My question is for Ms. Jensen in Rochester. I'm kind of wearing my chair of the Transportation Finance and Policy hat here because transportation is one of the leading sources of greenhouse gas emissions. So I'm interested in one thing you said about electric vehicle infrastructure, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about your plans for that. And I think a couple of the testifiers talked about the cost, infrastructure costs of climate change, and I'm interested particularly in roads and bridges. We've had so many extreme weather events in southern Minnesota, and I know there's been a lot of damage done to the infrastructure because of that. So interested to know what Rochester's doing on electric vehicle infrastructure and roads and bridges as it relates to climate.
Ms. Jensen.
Thank you. I can definitely speak to the first part of that for sure. So we've installed to this point 6 electric vehicle charging stations within our downtown parking ramps, and moving into 2021, plan to embark on an electric vehicle infrastructure planning process for our community, which will help us identify priority areas to install additional vehicles, electric vehicle chargers, as well as install a fast charger and potentially a couple public level 2 chargers throughout our community as well. So really just trying to build the adoption of electric vehicles within our community and build out that infrastructure to go along with that. Internally, our city is looking at our fleet as well and how we can continue to transition to electric vehicles within our fleet. We completed an electric vehicle fleet analysis at the end of 2019, which really showed a lot of opportunity for transitioning our fleet to more electric vehicles. So unfortunately, we weren't able to transition as many as we wanted in 2020 due to budget with the pandemic, but we do have plans to transition additional vehicles in 2021 here.
Representative Hornstein.
Okay, and thank you. That's really helpful to know, and I think a lot of good work being done on the municipal level on electric work. So maybe if Ms. Jensen, you're not able to answer this, I don't know if anyone else on the panel can talk a little bit about the impacts on infrastructure, road and bridge infrastructure specifically, and climate. I think there was some cost mentioned to that, $95 billion nationally, but do we have some data, you know, in Minnesota about the cost of extreme weather events on our transportation infrastructure?
Anybody looking to take that? I'm not sure we have the right expert on this panel. Right.
Well, we will be. Rest assured, members and Mr. Chair, it is something we'll be addressing in the Transportation Committee, the impact of climate on transportation. But just thought maybe we could get a teaser from this this panel. But we'll. I think it is very important, Mr. Chair, and it's something I'm going to be raising in this committee and the committee that I'm in charge of.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair? I apologize. Yes, Cindy Steinhauser, Community Development Director for the City of Rochester. And just to that, I apologize that we don't have that information, but I do know that our team that works on transportation issues as part of our development services and infrastructure team is gathering some of that information, and we'd be happy to provide it for a future committee consideration. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Steinhauser. And if you could get that to our committee administrator, we'll share it with the committee. Before we wrap, I just wanted to give Representative Bowe a chance to introduce himself since he wasn't able to earlier.
Thank you, Chair Long. I appreciate that. I had some connection problems this morning, which continue to plague me, but I hope you can hear me now.
Sure can.
Okay, very good. State Representative Greg Bowe, representing Eastern Carver County, District 47B, which is Chaska, Chanhassen, and Victoria. I've been an environmental professional for 20-some years, so, you know, excited to be a part of the Climate and Energy Committee and some of the things we'll be talking about here. Certainly have had some time to serve on the municipal power agencies as well, so kind of bring an understanding of some of the munis and the challenges that they face. As a conservative, I bring a kind of unique insight, I think, into some of the climate discussions where I seek to make sure we do it in a sustainable fashion. But looking forward to an interesting year, and I thank you for letting me be a part of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Bowe. Well, we are at time. Thank you all, everyone, for an excellent first hearing, and we will be reconvening on Thursday at 10:30 a.m. for the second in our opening series, this time on climate solutions that are being pursued in our state. And with that, we stand adjourned.